From The Recount, I'm Rena Ninen, and you're listening to The Recount Daily Pod. Today's Wednesday, August 18th.
My prediction will be that the kind of endless conflict we've gotten used to will continue regardless of what the Supreme Court says, simply because the Supreme Court really isn't at the root of our abortion battles.
That was Dr. Mary Ziegler, law professor at Florida State University, who recently spoke with us about the complex legal landscape of abortion rights in America. We're going to dig into that a little bit later, but first, your morning headlines. We begin in Afghanistan after days of confusion and panic. The Taliban has agreed to allow safe passage of civilians to the airport in Kabul. With U.S. forces firmly in control there, military and civilian evacuation flights are continuing. The Taliban held its first press conference since its takeover of Kabul on Tuesday, saying they don't want to make any internal or external enemies. The spokesperson added that women's rights would be protected within the norms of Islamic law. But there's reason to be skeptical. The last time the Taliban were in power, women and girls faced severe restrictions in their daily activities, including not being able to attend school. Meanwhile, a handful of Afghan women took to the streets to protest the return of Taliban rule. Work, education, and political participation is every woman's right, they shouted. The protests took place in front of Taliban forces. Video of the protests quickly went viral on social media. Time to roll up your sleeves again. The Biden administration will announce today that booster shots are now recommended for everyone as soon as mid-September. U.S. health officials had previously approved a third vaccine for immunocompromised people. The new guidance will give all Americans access to a third shot of either Moderna or Pfizer. Johnson & Johnson is waiting on more data before making any recommendations on boosters. According to the New York Times, the first priority will be for nursing home residents, healthcare workers, and emergency workers. Older adults will be the next priority, followed by the general public. The recommendation comes after reports from Israel show that protection starts to decrease after 8 months. The timing of when kids will be able to have their first shot is still outstanding while trials continue. Meanwhile, TSA has extended their mask mandate to January of 2022 for air travel. It was scheduled to end in September. The rule also applies to travelers on all public transportation, including trains, subways, and buses. Planned Parenthood of Montana filed a lawsuit on Monday challenging four new rules that block access to abortions in the state. The laws, which go into effect on October 1st, would ban abortions after 20 weeks, restrict access to abortion pills, and require that patients be asked if they want to see the ultrasound, and prohibit insurance companies that cover abortions from being on the federal exchange for health insurance. Montana joined several other states in passing a record number of laws restricting abortion since January. The biggest battle looms in the fall, though, as the Supreme Court considers a case that may overturn the central precedent of Roe v. Wade. Has the tide of American sentiment finally shifted? We dig into the legal landscape in today's Daily Deep Dive.
Today, we're talking with Dr. Mary Ziegler, law professor at Florida State University and author of several books, including Abortion and the Law. Dr. Ziegler, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. So far this year, a record 90 laws restricting abortions have gone into effect across the country. Why now?
Well, I think the short answer is the Supreme Court, because it was widely believed that until the court had a 5-justice conservative majority, it would be impossible for abortion opponents to get Roe v. Wade reversed. But then, of course, when Anthony Kennedy retired in 2018 and Donald Trump appointed Brett Kavanaugh as his successor, it seemed that we did have that 5-justice conservative majority, and we saw a surge in abortion restrictions, including the first heartbeat bills, you may remember, which came on tap in 2019. But then, of course, John Roberts, the Chief Justice, seemed to kind of back away from the idea of reversing Roe in the summer of 2020. So we then saw another surge following the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett, because that gave us a 6-justice conservative supermajority. So even if John Roberts or one of the other court members gets cold feet about the idea of reversing Roe, it almost doesn't matter anymore. There's a conservative insurance policy. And so as states see it, this is the moment to try to reverse Roe. And states are really competing with one another to have that opportunity and also to put in place the kind of restrictions that would never have been enforceable in a world where Roe is likely going to be intact.
You mentioned the heartbeat abortion ban. That essentially is once a heartbeat is detected, you cannot have an abortion. And that usually is around 6 weeks. Nearly a dozen states have passed heartbeat abortion bans, but none have taken effect because of the legal challenges, except for Texas. In May, Texas Governor Greg Abbott signed into law banning these abortions. What does the heartbeat ban mean for Texas once it does take effect in September?
Well, Texas's law is a little bit different because Texas is trying to argue essentially it's not us enforcing the law. So in most states that have a heartbeat bill, if you perform an abortion after fetal heartbeat is detected, if you're a doctor, you face penalties from the loss of your medical license to criminal penalties. Texas is essentially saying, we, the state, are not enforcing this. We're outsourcing enforcement to literally anyone in Texas. It doesn't have to be anyone who knows the person having the abortion or knows anybody performing the abortion. It's just anyone in the state can be a vigilante and take this up. So the reason Texas is doing that in part is so that it's harder for anyone to sue Texas and establish that the law is unconstitutional. So in practical terms, it's more likely that citizens in Texas will see this law go into effect, even if the Supreme Court takes some time to overrule Roe or surprises everyone and doesn't overturn Roe entirely. And that means, of course, that there will be kind of an industry in the state of Texas to enforce this law, largely led by anti-abortion activists who will try to find out if people have had abortions or help with abortions. It's designed to have a chilling effect, right, and discourage people in the state of Texas from performing abortions or aiding people in getting abortions because they don't want to face the kind of lawsuit and legal bill that the Texas law threatens people with. It also sets a sort of strange and potentially dangerous precedent for other laws because, of course, the model Texas is creating here is that you don't need to have any personal connection to a case. It doesn't need to be your personal business for you to get involved. And you could imagine that that could be a problem or it could create a kind of dangerous precedent in a lot of areas of life involving other kinds of injuries or other kinds of issues like guns. So I think the most ironic thing is that by the time 2022 or 2023 rolls around, the Texas law isn't even going to strike many people as extreme because the origins of it in Texas were really Texas lawmakers' desire not to get sued because a lot of states that had passed the criminal version of the heartbeat bill in earlier years had been sued, had had their bill's constitutionality questioned, and had lost in federal court, and then had been forced to pay pretty hefty attorney's fees to organizations like Planned Parenthood. And Texas had been trying to pass that kind of heartbeat bill, but it hadn't gotten off the ground because some GOP legislators said, hey, we don't want to pay that kind of legal fee. So Texas's law is not a direct challenge to Roe v. Wade, is not a criminal bill because Texas wanted to have its cake and eat it too, basically to ban abortions at 6 weeks without the legal consequences. But many other states, of course, do want to pass laws that are obviously unconstitutional because they want the Supreme Court to change how the Constitution is interpreted. And so we're likely to see even more extreme bills with even more sweeping penalties, particularly criminal penalties, emerging as the court moves closer to overruling Roe.
Take me back for a second, Dr. Ziegler. In 1973, we had this landmark case, Roe v. Wade. It set a nationwide precedent for abortions. What did that precedent do? And what does it mean for our country?
So Roe v. Wade came on the heels of some other cases that had talked about a right to privacy in the Constitution. Now, there's no language in the Constitution spelling out a right to privacy, but this right to privacy had been recognized by the court as a sort of logical outgrowth of things that were in the text of the Constitution, like your right to be free of unreasonable searches and seizures. So the court had first recognized that right when it came to married people's use of birth control, had recognized it in terms of parents' rights to control the upbringing of their children, and eventually individual people's right to use birth control. So Roe extended it and said this right to privacy is broad enough to encompass a person's decision on abortion. At first, Roe said some stuff that we no longer think about, really made the right about doctors' prerogatives to practice medicine as much as about women or pregnant people's prerogatives to dictate their own reproductive futures. Roe also, in effect, invalidated most of the abortion laws on the books at the time in the country. There were only arguably all of them clashed with Roe, and all but a handful of states still had in place a significant number of abortion restrictions because Roe said that in the first trimester, you can't really regulate abortion much at all, which contradicted what most states had in place. Roe also said that an unborn child or fetus isn't a person within the 14th Amendment, and that the state didn't have a compelling interest in protecting life from conception. And both of those things, of course, were the leading constitutional arguments of abortion opponents in the states at the time. So Roe was a pretty revolutionary decision in two ways, right? One, it kind of rewrote the rules on what states could do when it came to abortion and forced almost all states to go back to the drawing board with their abortion policies. And second, it kind of changed what the constitutional right to privacy meant, because when Roe talked about privacy, it was talking much more about your autonomy to make crucial life decisions, even when those decisions were stigmatized or controversial.
We've got to take a quick break, but we'll be back with Dr. Mary Ziegler, law professor at Florida State University, on the Recount Daily Pod. Welcome back to the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from the Recount and iHeartRadio. We're here with Dr. Mary Ziegler, law professor at Florida State University, talking about abortion rights in the U.S. You were mentioning how states are in many ways competing against each other as they're creating these limits on abortion. The Supreme Court this fall will actually hear a Mississippi abortion case that'll challenge Roe v. Wade, that precedent. How did this happen? How did it make its way to the Supreme Court? And do you really believe Roe v. Wade will be overturned in America?
So the case is called Dobbs Jackson versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. Mississippi passed a law banning abortion at 15 weeks gestation on the theory that that's when fetal pain is possible. Other states had passed fetal pain laws, but Mississippi's was unique because most states that had passed such laws claimed that fetal pain was possible at 20 weeks. Now, just as an aside, most medical experts didn't think fetal pain was possible at either 15 or 20 weeks. They thought it was possible only roughly 5 to 6 weeks later. But at any rate, Mississippi's argument was that when fetal pain existed, it was barbaric to allow abortions to continue. The reason this was legally significant was because under Roe and its successor cases, states were not allowed to ban abortion outright until viability, which is the point at which survival outside the womb is possible. And usually that's marked at around 24 weeks, but it's certainly not possible at 15 weeks, even in exceptional cases of survival. So Mississippi's law was a direct contradiction of the Roe v. Wade framework. The Supreme Court really sat on the case for months last year, an unusually long time to wait to decide whether to take a case. And then when they did decide to hear the Dobbs decision, they only wanted to hear what most commentators saw as the most kind of explosive question, which was whether the viability framework was going to last and whether states could ban all or some abortions before viability. So in order for the Supreme Court to uphold this Mississippi law, the court either has to get rid of the viability standard or has to overrule Roe v. Wade altogether. There's no other way to uphold the Mississippi law. And so I think most commentators believe that it's likely that the court will overturn Roe v. Wade, not necessarily in the Dobbs case. That said, I think it's quite likely that the Dobbs case will either open the door to many more state restrictions of abortion or will probably lay the foundation for a decision in the next year or two that will reverse Roe v. Wade.
So what does that mean for abortion rights activists, people who really believe abortion should be legal in America?
Well, I think it means that the conflict will move into the states and that there'll just be a new chapter to the conflict. I mean, I think it's a mistake to believe that reversing Roe would put an end to the conflict, particularly because most likely what the court will say is not that abortion in America is illegal. They'll most likely say the Constitution is silent on abortion and each state will decide for itself. So in the short term, that means that there'll be a war in each state about the terms of access to abortion. It will likely make abortion a more central issue in elections, either in 2020 depending on what the court says in 2024 or beyond. And of course, the Supreme Court will continue to be up for grabs as well. We've already heard talk of court reform on the left. I think those conversations will intensify if the court reverses Roe. And we've seen in the past 50 years with the fight to reverse Roe that no Supreme Court decision necessarily lasts forever. So I would expect abortion rights supporters to mount a similar campaign to reestablish constitutional protection for abortion, both at state Supreme Courts, but also at the federal Supreme Court.
There were more abortion restrictions enacted across the U.S. this year than any other year. I know we mentioned this at the top of this podcast, but the last time there was that record was set in 2011, when states passed 89 abortion restrictions over the course of the entire year. Why are we seeing this uptick of restriction on abortion over the past decade? What do you attribute that to?
Yeah, I mean, part of it obviously is the Supreme Court, but as you pointed out, the uptick predates the changes to the Supreme Court and goes back really to the Tea Party wave of 2010. So I think part of what we're seeing are both changes to the Republican Party and changes to the political map. So first, with changes to the political map, with gerrymandering, and also just the polarization of districts as people move from place to place, there are a lot of districts that are so profoundly conservative that there really isn't a political penalty anymore for passing abortion legislation that's well outside the political mainstream when we look at the national or even the state level. So there are politicians who can make political profit from passing laws that to most observers look pretty extreme. Second, I think the GOP as a whole in the era of the Tea Party and Donald Trump has sort of banked on a strategy of whipping up support from its most zealous voters and not necessarily playing to the median voter, and combining that with, of course, measures that make it harder for lots of people to vote. So instead of appealing to the most people in the electorate, both shrinking the electorate and maximizing turnout among core GOP voters. And extreme abortion laws can do that, because while most people in America are kind of on the middle, what we refer to as the mushy middle on abortion, most voters in that group don't really vote based on abortion. They vote based on a variety of other issues. And it's only people who care the most about abortion, who often really on the right or the left have the most absolutist stances, who vote based on abortion. So the idea of passing these extreme laws is that that's a great way to turn out the most committed anti-abortion voters. And that increasingly is in line with the GOP strategy of sort of rallying the base rather than maximizing support.
So a survey was conducted this past spring by Pew Research, and it found that 6 in 10 adults, or 59%, really believe that abortion should be legal in all or most cases. 39% only say that it should be illegal. Why is there this discrepancy between public opinion and legislation?
Well, I think one of the things that's the most striking about public opinion and legislation is that most Americans really kind of like the status quo when you dig into it, right? So if you ask Americans, do you think Roe v. Wade should be preserved? Overwhelming majorities say yes. If you ask, do you think abortion should be legal? Clear majorities say yes. If you ask them then about specific restrictions, their majority is in favor of abortion restrictions, but not bans, which is sort of the America we're living in, right? Where abortion can be inaccessible and regulated, but not banned. I think the reason there's a disconnect in part is because it's the courts that are deciding questions about abortion, and courts are not as responsive to popular opinion as elected officials are supposed to be. And also because the way our party politics around abortion have shaped up, politicians have used abortion as a wedge issue to win over voters for whom that's the key question going into election day.
Dr. Ziegler, before you go, I want to ask you, what do you think is the future for abortion legislation in this country? What's your biggest hope and your biggest fear?
So my hope is that if there's something seismic like an overruling of Roe, that that will change the landscape enough to open the door to some more thoughtful conversations about abortion, because those are already happening. They're just not happening in our courts or in our legislatures. I think my biggest fear, or probably my prediction, will be that the kind of endless conflict we've gotten used to will continue regardless of what the Supreme Court says, simply because the Supreme Court really isn't at the root of our abortion battles. What is at the root of those battles is very deeply different views about everything from the nature of fetal life, the role of mothers, really to the nature of scientific authority and scientific evidence, or the roles of courts and democracy. So there are a lot of different views that really predate Roe and will likely continue after it that have inflamed this conflict and made abortion the most preeminent culture war in the United States. And I don't really expect that to change.
Dr. Mary Ziegler, law professor at Florida State University and author of Abortion and the Law. Dr. Ziegler, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And now to the look ahead. Here's what else we're watching today. New Zealand starts a 3-day lockdown after one case of COVID, yes, one, was detected in its largest city of Auckland. It's the country's first reported case in 6 months. After 2 years of delays, R&B singer R. Kelly is in court today for the start of a long-awaited trial. The R&B singer, who was denied any wrongdoing, has been charged with federal racketeering and sex trafficking. If convicted, Kelly faces decades in prison. The band Kiss resumes their End of the Road tour today. The tour was abruptly canceled in 2020 due to the pandemic. The face-painting, high-heel-wearing classic hard rock band has been entertaining fans for just over 48 years. Have a great day. See you back tomorrow morning. This is the Recount Daily Pod, a podcast from the Recount and iHeartRadio. Our thanks to Dr. Rachel Ziegler for being on the show. And if you like this episode, please subscribe to the Recount Daily Pod and leave us a rating on the Apple Podcast app. I'm your host, Rena Ninen.